welcome to the Modern Wool Podcast, where we share the secrets of sustainable small batch wool straight from our mill, Abundant Earth Fiber. I'm Lydia Christiansen. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to the very first episode of Modern Wool, in which I will be talking about the genesis of our mill, where yarn comes from, and why we feel it has such incredible value in the modern world. So, Abundant Earth Fiber is the name of our fiber mill. This is where we turn raw wool from local sheep, alpaca, rabbits, and goat into high-quality yarn. We do the scouring, carding, pin drafting, spinning, plying, and all the little things that happen in between right here at our mill. My husband, Alan, and I work together to run the mill and all the aspects of the business, along with Leah, our incredibly talented full-time assistant. Alan and I have four boys, two in college, two in elementary school. And about 5 years ago, when our youngest was still in diapers, we just got to thinking that life was just too easy. And why not just quit our jobs and start up a fiber mill? No, not really. It wasn't like that. It was more like, man, life's hard, life's busy, and it's always going to be. So why not spend more time doing things we love and with people we love? Owning this mill has challenged us and changed us more than we ever imagined. We work insanely hard, but we're satisfied by simpler things, and we get to spend way more time doing things that we love and with people we love. Our children recognize that work is not something that we leave the family to go do. It is the family. It's part of our life all the time, and they're very much included in that in different ways. They get to celebrate with us when we have success, and they know how to pitch in when things are hard and we're all putting in extra time. I think from their perspective, it's their mill too, and they're just as proud as we are of what we've created. The name for our mill, Abundant Earth Fiber, comes from the idea that everything we need as human beings is already right in front of us. No matter who you are or where you are, we all depend on the same natural world equally. We breathe the same air. We drink the same water. We live by the warmth of the same sun. There isn't anything on this earth that doesn't come from this earth. So why does it feel so hard sometimes to feel connected with it? See, I think when you step back and you recognize a personal connection with the natural world, it starts to feel like as humans, we have more in common than we have differences. Personally, I found my connection with the natural world through spinning yarn from wool. I started hand spinning long before even knowing what a fiber mill is. Through spinning, I started to hear this idea running through my head over and over and over. If you love your craft, then you'll love your materials. If you love your materials, you'll love the source. Now, I'm not saying that we're all crafters. We're not. But we're all doing something. We're all making something. And whatever the thing is that you're creating in your world, if you love it, you'll love your tools as well. You'll love the materials that help you create it. And if you love those things, eventually they'll lead you back to the natural world. So maybe spending more time doing things you love is currency for making the world a better place. Hey, let's see if we can do a little experiment with finding that connection. Take a minute and let your eyes wander around the room, wherever you are, and focus on one object. It doesn't matter what it is. And if you can't see anything around you, use your imagination to think of an item that you maybe see or handle on a day-to-day basis. So just anything. Now, focus on that item in detail and see if you can discover what it's made out of. How is it put together? Where are the joints? Are the hinges? What's the assembly? The construction? How closely can you see the materials that it was made out of? can you imagine that item in its natural state as a raw material? Can you imagine what it looks like? What is it? Where is it? What are its surroundings as a raw material? What color is it naturally? Can you picture how that item is collected or harvested or acquired by humans? Can you imagine who the people are that do that work? Can you imagine where it goes to be processed or made into the thing that you're thinking about right now? How clear or fuzzy are those images? It's likely that most of us have pretty fuzzy images about most of the things around us on a day-to-day basis. But really, don't worry, that's okay. The luxury of the modern world is that we don't need to be experts about everything, right? Now more than ever, we have the freedom to choose how we spend our time and what we'll focus on. The hardest part, shockingly so, is simply knowing what you want. I want to understand wool. I want to learn everything there is to learn about wool, and I want to understand the people and the places in our world affected by it. That's what I want. Of course, I want my mill to provide for my family. I want to be proud of the things that I make. But even deeper than that is my desire to learn about wool. And really, I think that's been the common thread throughout all the work we've done at our mill from the beginning, is learning about wool. And we're at a point now where we would like to start sharing some of the things that we've learned with other people and hopefully make the path a little more abundant for the next generation. That doesn't in any way mean that we have it all figured out. It just means we have learned a lot. We've put in a lot of hours and we've made a lot of mistakes. One of the greatest lessons that I've learned from spinning yarn, both by hand and machine, is not to hate myself for my mistakes. I've made so many. But every time I make a mistake, I have the opportunity to learn something and be able to do my job intentionally better next time. It's those moments of having a question on the tip of my mind that makes me hungry to create and excited to go to work. Personally, I think experience is great. But curiosity is even better because it keeps you moving forward. And I hope we still have a lot of it left ahead of us. One of the most common questions that people come to me with is, where does yarn come from? Most of us can picture an adorable, fluffy sheep on green pasture. We know mentally that wool comes from sheep, and we can picture a sheep, most of us. But then what happens? Let me walk you through this. A farmer tends the land which sheep graze. Sheep turn grass and water and sunshine into wool, grows on their backs naturally, and it's shorn off the animal just like a haircut, once, sometimes twice a year, depending on the breed. 100% of good quality wool comes from good quality soil. Good farming is good soil maintenance. That's true for wool, the same it is for vegetables. My work with wool begins the moment it comes off the sheep. I use my senses to grade wool for quality and then skirt it, which means removing any portions of the fleece that's unwashable. This is one of my favorite tasks, though, because an individual fleece can vary year to year, depending on environmental changes or major events in the life of the animal. Examining an individual fleece is like reading a story that only gets told once. I love it. After the quality of a fleece is determined, I'll choose the best application for the wool. It'll have to get scoured and carded and spun, which each on their own are topics we could spend days talking about, and it's really why we've created this podcast. At our mill, we have refurbished industrial machines that I had to teach myself how to use because they don't come with instruction manuals and there are definitely no YouTubes on this topic. Now, let's go back to that sheep that you were picturing grazing on green pasture. I would like to congratulate everyone out there who was able to picture their sheep in any color other than white. Be honest. What color was your sheep? most of the sheep in the world are white. So, I mean, it stands to reason that you would think of a white sheep. But did you know there are hundreds of different breeds of sheep, all with different attributes in their wool? And sheep aren't the only fiber animals out there. Some breeds of sheep, though, have dozens of recognizable colorings or markings. In order to understand the quality of wool, you have to be aware of the diversity that's out there in the first place. The most influential book that I've ever read about wool is called The Fleece and Fiber Source Book. And there's a companion book called The Field Guide to Fleece. Both books are written by Deb Robson and Carol Acarius. I hope you'll take a look at those books, even if you're somebody who has no intention of working with yarn, because it's really fascinating to be connected with a raw material and the way these books make it possible. They're really fascinating. I hope you'll take a look at them. I started reading those books years before we ever conceived of starting a fiber mill. It all started back when my husband, Alan, gave me a Lendrum spinning wheel for my birthday. That wheel started all of this. I was so anxious to learn how to use it. In fact, I took a 15-minute tutorial from Marcy Johnson up at the Oak Harbor Spin-In here on Whidbey Island. And to date, that is the only formal spinning education, if you can call it formal, that I have ever had. It's kind of uncomfortable to be bad at something. It's uncomfortable to learn a new skill because you have to be bad at it in the beginning. That wheel, for a long time, sat in the corner of our dining room as an ornament. And I took 5-10 minutes at a time to try to teach myself how. It was really frustrating. But I learned from my experiences. I learned from what my hands were telling me. And I learned from my mistakes. Once I'd figured out the basics of hand spinning, my curiosity just exploded. And I wanted to know how to turn the wool that was on the backs of my neighbor's sheep into yarn. Here I was spinning fiber that somebody had given me, and there it is right there on the animal. How does it go from there to my wheel? I had no idea, and I wanted to know. So my son Leif was less than 1 year old at the time, and I felt kind of limited in what I was able to do. So I just packed him up in the car and started driving around Whidbey Island looking for sheep. We literally did drive-bys anywhere that I had known there to be sheep or learned about. People started calling me and telling me that they knew where wool was, and I would go track it down. In the process of hunting for wool, I discovered that most of what was being shorn off the animals was just sitting in a barn. Most people wondering what to do with it. I was asking them what they do with it, and they were asking me what they should do with it. So I was able to get my hands on lots of different kinds of wool. I started reading Deb Robson's book and discovering what these breeds are, and seeing the attributes of the different breeds in the wool that I was getting was really fascinating, because most often the owners didn't know the genetics on the animals. And so it was really kind of sleuthing out wool and teaching myself how to wash it and card it and all the steps of processing wool that we now do at the mill. I think it's important to note here that something else was happening at the same time. Bags and bags of wool started filling our house. Skeins of yarn were everywhere. I had sort of commandeered way more than just that little corner of the dining room. I found myself spinning yarn and weaving and washing wool as a way to think about a more important question in my life, which was, what do I want to do? I had been a public school teacher for several years, and although I really love teaching, I started to realize how exhausting it was, and I felt like really I was giving way more than I was being given back by my career. And so there I was, spinning and weaving and washing wool and asking the question, what's the thing that I can do that I'll never get tired of? And there it was right in front of me. I remember this one morning I woke up and I knew what I was about to say, but it scared me. And I put my arm over on Alan's shoulder to hold him, like you know how you do when you're driving and you're afraid the passenger is going to lurch forward, so you put your arm out, right? That's what I did. I put my arm over to hold him back from falling out of the bed. And I said, "Alan, I think we need a meal." I'm pretty sure he said, "What's a meal?" And I said, "I'm not sure." And then he said, "I guess we should find out." We had that conversation sometime in mid-January of 2014. It's typical for a cottage meal to come together in creation anywhere between a year or two or more for research and funding to come together. We had that conversation in January. I immediately started researching and talking to people, and opportunities and doorways were just open. In February, I flew out to Oklahoma to research some equipment that was for sale. And really, this trip was about me learning how the machines work and trying to understand if these were the pieces that we wanted. Well, we ended up buying them, and we arranged for a semi-truck in April to deliver this equipment back to us in Washington. Shortly after we made that purchase, Chuck McDermott called me out of the blue and said, "Hey, I heard you're buying one of my old carding machines. I think you're really going to be in need of some spinners too." And he had a connection with a mill in Indiana that was going out of business and had an opportunity to buy some spin frames that would have otherwise gone to scrap metal. Well, my initial reaction was, no way. We've already spent way more money than we thought. I don't really know what I'm doing. It seems reckless, so no. And then I couldn't sleep for 3 days. And I felt that this was an opportunity that would pass and I might regret it. And I couldn't stand the thought of regretting it. And so I called him back and I said, "Are they still available?" And I just closed my eyes and said yes. In hindsight, I can't imagine doing what we have done without those spinners. And I'm so glad that we took that leap. We had everything delivered and set up and fully functional by June. And we had our grand opening at the end of July 2014. It was an insane 7 months of our life, but it was just the beginning. The first 18 months, at least, of operating the mill were spent 16, 18-hour days, 7 days a week, just learning and making mistakes and picking myself back up. And at the time, Alan was still working full-time, which really sustained us. And a lot of the burden of taking care of the kids and looking after things at home fell on him. So he was working just as hard as I was to maintain our life. It was an incredibly challenging time for us. I'm not saying it wasn't foolish, and I'm definitely not recommending this path to anyone out there. I'm just saying this is what happened. There were dozens of times when we either could have failed or did fail. And for whatever reason, it didn't stop us. We kept moving forward. We kept learning. What started out as curiosity and a quest for raw material had turned into this mill and an entirely new lifestyle for us. As a mill owner, I've always felt a strong sense of responsibility for the things that we make to be the best quality we can make them, to be made the most efficiently we can make them, and to creatively solve problems that exist in the small batch supply chain. I find myself in the middle of a relationship between farms who produce and other yarn businesses, as well as hand crafters who use the finished yarn. Now, in the small batch yarn world, and I think this might be true in other industries as well, it seems that each member of the supply chain is highly focused on their area of specialty and what they need. But very few people understand each other's position in the supply chain. My quest for raw material had expanded into a quest for understanding these different perspectives. By spending time getting out there, physically meeting with farmers and looking at different kinds of wool, I learned early on that it's personal relationships with our local farms that enables me to see with my own eyes how the land and animals are cared for, and also to be in touch with what our family farms need in order to make a fair trade for the wool. Now, I realize that I just used the word local, and I feel like I should stop and talk about that for a second. We are so proud of what we make at our mill, and we think of our yarn as local, sustainable, small batch wool. The problem is, I can't use the word local or sustainable without raising confusion. These are words that mean so many different things to different people that on the surface, they hardly mean anything at all. If you had to explain what local means to a child, what would you say? Do you know what the word local means to you? It depends on what you value and what you need. We all have a different combination of answers to those questions. I've come to see the word local as meaning personal relationships with our sources, so that we know exactly what goes into our skeins from farm to yarn. If we have a geographic boundary, it's regional and domestic. It's as far as I need to go to get the quality that I need from sources that I trust. And what about the word sustainability? For us, sustainability is when the work we do with our yarn community of farms, mills, and fiber artists is in balance with our shared reliance on the natural world. It's a complicated balance. It's always in motion. But by focusing our work on small batches, we can work with diversity. We can adapt to changes rather than working against them. We can give more attention to detail in small batches, which means higher quality and less waste overall. Another benefit is that our wool passes through fewer hands before it reaches your needles. So it's easier to visualize the whole path from farm to yarn and feel connected with each other and with the natural world in the process. Now, I'm not saying that small batches are better than large-scale production or that mass-produced wool is bad, not at all. We need large mills and they need us, I think now more than ever. The more diversity in the community, the stronger we can become. But we need to do the work of understanding each other as well. Wool moves on an industrial scale so much differently than it does in small scale. It's really apples and oranges. In the industrial world, wool gets classed and skirted on the ranch where it's shorn. And then it's packed into bales that hold between 300, maybe 600 pounds of fiber. Those bales are sold to a broker who auctions it off to the large mills all over the world. And when you have to move a large volume of wool like that, you're at the mercy of market prices or whatever the broker is willing to pay. Wool pools are organizations that help move wool off the farm, but are essentially another middleman between the farm and the broker. So farms who give their wool to Woolpool rarely make enough to even cover the cost of food for the animals. Industrial scale processing is an essential part of domestic wool, but it does present some problems. And what we seem to be seeing today in modern wool is a sense of scarcity at the industrial scale. Now, let me give you a broader picture of what's happening with wool in the United States right now. I'm going to throw some numbers at you, which are the latest research published by the USDA on wool production in the United States, okay? In the year that I was born, 1978, our nation's farms produced over 100 million pounds of raw wool. In 2016, which is the last year this data was published, it was only 27 million pounds. Okay, 100 million pounds of raw wool to 27 in my lifetime. In the year I was born, our mills processed just over 115 million pounds of wool. In 2016, we only processed 15 million. Most of the mills that were around in 1978 have long since gone out of business. Our family farms have declined in equal proportion. not one of our great states nor the federal government recognizes wool as a valuable commodity. The commercial value of sheep is meat. And the wool, more often than not, is considered a waste product. It's not even clear amongst a good number of ranchers how to value the wool. It only takes one generation for the knowledge to be lost, and it appears to me that this happened a long time ago. Now, this happens to be exactly where our smaller family farms excel. More often than not, family farms are run by people who love the land and the animals, and that's why they're doing it. A small flock, correct me if I'm wrong, according to the American sheep industry, is considered a farm that is tending less than 100 in their flock size. So from my perspective, most of the family farms I work with are tending one or two dozen animals, maybe up to 50 or 60. That's the scale mostly that I see. We can look to our family farms for higher quality wool, efficient practices, and responsible care of the animals. You can't compare the issues on an industrial scale with those at a small batch scale. It's such a different world. And from what I see, where there is scarcity on the industrial level, there is abundance at the small batch level. The problem is, how can our small farms excel when they have to compete in a marketplace overwhelmingly dominated by bulk rates and cheap imports? How can that raw material excel when cottage mills running small batches are fewer and far between, plus struggling with similar concerns themselves? Isn't that the question? Does U.S. wool have value? Is there value in family farming and small batch processing? And is this natural resource worth all the effort we put into it? Now, I believe that each of you listening has just as much authority in establishing the value of wool as any of our small batch farms and mills do. If wool has value in the modern world, fiber artists, handcrafters, and people who just care are the ones that make it so. By including high-quality local wool in your craft, you complete the circle between farms and mills by sending revenue directly back to the families doing the work. Every purchase you make validates the fact that natural fiber has value. Your purchases demonstrate to the families involved, my own children included, that meaningful work has value. In addition to all this, choosing small batch local wool connects us collectively to the natural world. It's so much more to us than just yarn. We stake our livelihood on the belief that the earth gives abundantly all the things we need, and that if we're efficient with them, always improving on quality, there will be more than enough to go around. I'll wrap up this podcast on the thought that sent me down this path in the first place. If you love your craft, you'll love your materials. And if you love your materials, you'll love the source. Thanks a lot for listening.